My name's Sean Talbot. I'm going to speak to you this morning about this, Toxic Stress and the Wisdom of Balance. The title that you have in the brochure is The Cortisol Connection and Why Stress Makes You Fat and Ruins Your Health. So I'll talk a little bit about that too. But I want to kind of focus the discussion, and I want it to be a discussion rather than holding your questions till the end if you have questions. If you see a question, see something on the slide that you have a question about, let's talk about it there. We've got, I think we have 90 minutes for this session this morning. So that should give us plenty of time for me to get through my slides and a lot of time for us to have some discussion. Okay? But where I want to try to lead the discussion is towards this concept, not just of stress, but one of toxic stress, which basically means enough stress in your life that it results in a detrimental health outcome. How many people in here have a nutrition background at all? Raise your hands. Okay, just a few. More psychology backgrounds? Counseling backgrounds? Okay. I'm a nutritionist, and so I'll be speaking to you today from maybe a little bit of a different perspective than you're used to hearing at a conference like this. I'll typically talk at nutrition conferences, and I'll talk about cortisol and testosterone and neurotransmitters and enzymes and all that kind of stuff. But as a nutritional biochemist, that's what my PhD is in, that's what my training is in. Rather than just making nutrition recommendations or exercise recommendations or stress management recommendations, I really like people to focus back in on the biochemistry of that. So I'll talk quite a bit today about cortisol metabolism or testosterone metabolism. I might talk a little bit about enzyme metabolism, hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase, big long name for an enzyme that involved in cortisol metabolism. I'll talk a little bit about dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin balances, things like that. And I do that because, at least in my experience of the people that I work with, it's very empowering for them to know that it's not just the stress that's out there that they need to control, out there in the world, but that stress is causing a physiological or biochemical change in their bodies, and there's lots we know that we can change that. So a great deal of what I'll talk about to you today is this concept of restoring balance in the body that is upset by different stressors that we put ourselves under. Okay? So with that as a lead-in and a context, how many people downloaded the slide set from the website? Okay, the slide set that you downloaded is vastly different than the one that I have here. I have a terrible habit of working on slides on the plane on the way to a conference. So the two website addresses that you see up here, you can contact me through either of those, and I can email you the updated slide set, or you can give me your business card after, and you know I'll just write on the back of it, send slides, and I can just email it to you, okay? I apologize for that, but I think this slide set's much better. Has a lot of more really good information. Okay, so the prevalence of chronic stress, right? When I talk to a nutrition conference, right, and there's a room full of dietitians, or I talk to a sports medicine conference and there's a room full of exercise physiologists, this kind of information that you see on this slide, the prevalence of chronic stress, is, I don't know if it's a revelation to them, but it's just not something that they're steeped in. It's not something that they necessarily study. So when I put up statistics like this that show that studies show that 50 to 60% of all lost working days are related to stress, or the amount of dollars or euros that stress costs us as a society in any industrialized country, the people in those sessions are typically, you know, set back on their heels a little bit, that they didn't realize it was that big a deal, right? People, I think, kind of abstractly know stress is a big deal, and abstractly know, yeah, stress is bad for us, but don't know when you actually look at the statistics of disease incidence, of healthcare costs, of lost working days, those sorts of things, don't know how much it does impact our bodies. The statistics I want you to focus on, though, are the three at the bottom that I've put in red. 65 to 90% of people, these are U.S. statistics, 65 to 90% of the American population have enough stress in their lives that it results in a detrimental health outcome, whether that health outcome means depression or chronic fatigue or fibromyalgia or, you know, any of the purely stress-related diseases. But then we can factor into that also diseases that are not necessarily caused by stress but are certainly exacerbated by stress, things that I'll talk about today, things like obesity, things like diabetes, things like maybe not frank diabetes, but interference with blood sugar control. different types of, perhaps not dementia, but at least problems with memory and problems with memory consolidation and memory recall. So, I mean, no matter what statistics you look at, if you look at the American Psychological Association, 65%, you look at the American Institute of Stress, 90%, it's more people than not who have that much stress in their lives that it's causing a detrimental health outcome. Which, you know, leads me to, you know, start off a lot of the seminars that I give by telling people that I'm going to be speaking to them about the biggest or the most important or the most prevalent health issue facing us today. Because the only health issue that's bigger than that from a prevalence standpoint, 65 to 90%, is what? Well, there isn't one bigger than that. There's one that's very, very close to that, statistic-wise. Heart disease is about half of everybody, half of the population. So we'd be about 50, 55% there. It's 64%. Does anybody recognize that statistic? That's obesity, right? So 64% of the American population is either overweight or obese. And so stress is an even bigger issue if you look at it from an incidence perspective. They're about equivalent if you look at it from a medical cost perspective. Okay, so lots and lots and lots and lots of research on that topic, that stress represents a detrimental health effect to the body. If it's, I think this is important, I'll get into this a little bit later. It's not so much the degree of stress that you're under, it's more the duration of stress that you're under. So the chronicity, the chronic nature of that stress seems to be more important than the degree of the stress. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Okay? But if you look across just, you know, this I did on Saturday, I think. I update this slide every once in a while where I have a certain set of keyword sets that I'll run through the National Library of Medicine just to give people a perspective of how closely linked the research on stress or chronic stress is to various disease outcomes. And it's not all diseases. Not every disease, of course, is caused by stress. But what I've done here is you have the metabolic and long-term health effects of elevated stress, and then a disease, and then in parentheses, you've got the disease. So if we look at obesity, there are, as of last Saturday, there were 2,694 studies, human studies, on the link between chronic stress and the detrimental health outcome, which is obesity, through the biochemistry of stress either increasing appetite, accelerating muscle loss, suppressing fat oxidation, enhancing fat storage. And there are many, many others. It's actually tough to draw a line between the stress and diabetes studies and the stress and obesity studies, because they're pretty much the same condition. A lot of us are, you know, call that condition diabesity now, because it's really the same, different manifestations of the same biochemical situation in the body. But you can go down the list. Heart disease, you can see that we can look at the end outcome, or we can look at the biochemistry of it. Elevated lipids, cholesterol, triglyceride levels, elevated blood pressure. We can look at depression, anxiety, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, and you can see that's the largest one on the list, 22,491. And that includes not just outcomes of ADD or outcomes of depression or outcomes of anxiety disorder. It also includes biochemical studies in humans where we're looking at the stress and how it upsets the balance between those neurotransmitters, dopamine and norepinephrine and serotonin and the like. And so I'm not going to go through all these different bullet points, but you can see that it's an interesting time to be a nutrition researcher or a biochemical researcher, because you'll see, and I have a slide that speaks to this in a second, there's a very important, I think, convergence of people in my world, right? So I'm trained as a biochemist, and people in, and I'll say your world, right, just to make the point, this whole idea of mind-body, right? I mean, even when I was in school, which is not a long time ago, I've had my PhD for 10, 12 years, something like that, I would have professors, and I have colleagues now who still think of the separation between the mind and the body. And it's getting less and less and less and less and less. And it's because of these kinds of studies that show us, you know what, the mind can affect the health of the body through these biochemical or these neural or these immune pathways, and vice versa. Right? And I think that's not news to anybody sitting in this audience right now. But you'd be surprised how much of a revelation that is across different conferences that I'll be at. Yeah, question?
I missed what
So these are human these are peer-reviewed published studies in humans in these either disease states or the biochemistry of that disease state influenced by stress. Okay? Okay. So whenever I talk about stress to students, we'll use the motif of a lion is the stress and you're the zebra. All right, just to illustrate the fight or flight reaction. If anybody wants to read a really, really good book just about stress physiology, just to understand what the body goes through biochemically and hormonally when you're under stress, it's this book. It's called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. It was one of the first books that I read that got me, you know, from the biochemical world into more of the psychology world. Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers is written by Robert Sapolsky from Stanford. And Dr. Sapolsky, has anybody ever heard Dr. Sapolsky speak? Okay, he's terrific. Not only is he a very esteemed researcher, but he has a good knack for bringing his research down to a level that everybody can understand. So he does a lot of public seminars to get people to understand why stress is so bad for them. If you're having trouble picking Bob out from the slide, he's on your left in that picture. Does anyone know why he's pictured with a baboon? Because for the last at least 20 years, maybe close to 30 years now, he spends his summers on summer break from Stanford in Africa studying baboon social hierarchy, right? Why? Why do you care about that, right? People are laughing, right? How does that impact anything in the human world? It impacts everything in the human world because what he's studying basically is the stress of social interactions, which is our everyday life. And what he finds is that baboons put under the same social stress that humans, similar social stress to what humans are under, they get the same stress-related diseases. So those baboons who have the most stress versus the least stress have more abdominal obesity. They have more problems with their blood sugar control. They don't necessarily develop frank diabetes, but they have problems with blood sugar control. They get more parasites because their immune system is suppressed. They have more heart disease. They have more of all of those diseases that I showed you on the previous slide just because they're under the most stress. Which baboon do you think that is that's under the most stress? The king of the baboons, the alpha baboon? No? No takers on that one? I usually get a few hands. Everyone thinks that the boss has all the stress, right? No. How about the guy in the bottom? You got it. It's not the guy in the bottom. No, the guy in the top, he's given all the orders, right? He has no stress. Yells, grunts, bites, scratches. Everybody does what he says. The guy in the bottom doesn't have a lot of stress. He just hangs out until someone tells him what to do, and he does it, right? Very low stress, not a lot of decisions. It's the number two. It's the middle managers. That's exactly what it is. It's the middle managers of the baboon world. They're the ones that have the most stress. They're the ones who are getting yelled at to get things done faster. They're the ones that have to make sure that things get done. They're the ones who have to get the food. They're the ones that have to do the work. They're the ones who have to take care of the little baboons. So they're the ones who get the most stress and develop those stress-related conditions. Same as a human situation. So when we talk to students about the stress response, we say, there's your stress, it's a lion. The zebra perceives the stress, it's something that starts in the brain, causes a neurochemical, your brain perceives it, your brain causes some hormone production to happen. Some of it's fast because it's hardwired through the nervous system, some of it's slower because hormones have to get produced and go into the bloodstream and travel other places, but lots of neurochemistry happens. You perceive the stress, and you react to that stress. So in the case of a zebra, it's the fight or flight reaction. You run away or you fight off the zebra, and then the stress hormone or the stress response ends and those stress hormones dissipate and you get away from the stress. Or you don't get away from the stress. Either way, that stress response to that lion lasted 60 seconds, 90 seconds, right? Pretty good. Zebras can respond, can adapt very well to that. Humans can, baboons can, monkeys, cats, dogs, worms, across the animal kingdom, acute stress is fine. We can deal with that wonderfully well. And in some situations, acute stress actually makes the body work a little bit better. Immune system is upregulated. Immune system activity is upregulated in response to acute stress. Mental function is sharpened in response to acute stress. Lots and lots of things beneficial happen in response to acute stress, because if your body's working better and working more efficiently and firing on all cylinders, if you will, we're able to get away and thrive and survive, and that's exactly what we want. But does anybody know the answer to this? Why zebras don't get ulcers? Why don't they get ulcers? Because they're what? They don't stew in their own juices. That's exactly it. Because their stress is only acute. Their stress isn't chronic until you start studying the baboons who are in that chronic stress socially. The whole idea of that book and the whole idea of my research, some of which I'll share with you, is that zebras don't get ulcers. Humans don't get ulcers or stress-related conditions if their stress is only acute, right? So, ha, 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 our stress is never acute anymore, right? Because our stress is chronic. Our stress comes from bills and traffic and deadlines and family issues and our own social hierarchy and those sorts of things, okay? So that's part of the takeaway, I guess, is that it's not that the stress is bad, it's that chronic stress is bad. And even more importantly than that, it's the biochemical disruptions that I'll get into in a little bit that chronic stress causes that's bad and that causes our body to break down and become dysfunctional in a lot of ways. So humans are not zebras and are not meant to harbor chronic stress, but no animals are meant to harbor chronic stress. You can put any of those animals in a chronic stress situation and they'll develop stress-related diseases. And ulcers are the stereotypical stress-related disease. Anybody know how chronic stress leads to an ulcer? Or any gastrointestinal kind of a problem? Yeah. 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 Right. Right. So it's sort of tension throughout your whole body. Your stomach is churning out this excess acid, which is eating down the lining of your stomach. That can be a piece of it. There's another piece of it, though. This was the predominant thinking all through the 50s and 60s, even until the early 80s, until we found out another cause. So this is part of it. There's another piece going on. Yep, blood flow changes. So you're a zebra, right? Think back to the zebra. There's the lion. You need to mount a stress response. So where does your blood go? It goes to your muscles. It goes to your periphery so you can mount that stress response, that fight or flight reaction. And so digestion is the least of your worries right now. Why would you need blood and activity in your gut? It needs to get out to the periphery. You can digest later. Hopefully you'll digest later if you get away. There was another hand back there. So that's part of it. There's another piece of it too that we didn't know until just a decade ago. There's suppression of protection, mucosal linings. Yep. So that happens in the intestines and it happens in the stomach. Right. So another cognitive aspect of that that impacts on the digestive system is our appetite. Our appetite changes, and I'll get into this in a little bit. But our appetite changes in response to stress. So we've got tension being held in our body. We've got our protective mucosa going away. We've got blood flow going to different parts of the body than this part, so food stays in there. We've got cognitive changes, which are changing our appetite for different kinds of food that we're going to eat and bring into our gut. There's one more. Yes. Yeah. So bacteria are able to populate the gut at a much higher rate because our immune system is suppressed by chronic stress. By acute stress, it's actually upregulated a little bit. And so we've got the reason I want to talk through all that is because just this one thing, that mortgage that you're worrying about paying every month or whatever the source of the stress is causing all of these what look like completely unrelated biological effects in the body, and that's what's leading us to these detrimental health outcomes. So somebody might show that stress as an ulcer. Somebody else might show that stress as high blood pressure. Somebody else might show that stress as catching every cold and flu that comes down the pike. Somebody else might show that with abdominal weight gain. Somebody else might show that same stress in many, many different ways. Okay? So that's a concept I'd like to get people to at least think of through the rest of the presentation. But so here's the human stress response. Stress occurs from all those things we talked about. It's the same kind of primordial stress response that we still go through. So that bill might as well be a lion, or it might as well be a bus traveling at us that's going to run us over. It's the exact same stress response. Your brain perceives it. You have the very same neurochemical changes. But if our modern stressors are not permitting this fight or flight reaction, what happens? Our stress response continues. So we don't get, and very dramatically I have in the center there, stress is killing us, rest in peace, tombstone kind of thing. Because in a lot of ways it really is. So our stress doesn't end up being an acute stressor of 60 to 90 seconds. It ends up being days and weeks and months and years. And we're not having that fight or flight reaction. This is probably the reason, when I talk to a group of exercise physiologists, this is probably the reason that exercise is the most important thing. This is the most important effect of, or benefit of exercise. It's not calorie burn. It's not cardiorespiratory. It's the fact that it's allowing your body to mount that fight or flight reaction response that we're pretty much continually getting during most of our waking hours. Okay? I'll show you a little bit of data that speaks to this in a little bit, but in our lab, when we put people on an exercise program, it's very much geared towards rebalancing their cortisol-testosterone ratios, right? So we'll tell them, hey, there's all kinds of benefits to this exercise. It's going to help your heart. It's going to help your lungs. It's going to help your muscles. It's going to help your waistline. It's going to help your mental outlook. It's going to help all sorts of things, but this is the reason we want you to do it. We want you to do it because right now your hormones look like this, and we want them to look more like this. Okay, we want that exercise to have a balancing effect because it's your evolutionary stress response that your body is telling you to go through. Okay, so that's sort of the mentality of what we talk about in a program that we run out of our laboratory. So all of that has been leading up over the last decade or so. To this whole new area of research, I'm sure most of you have heard of before, psychoneuroimmunology. This idea that it isn't a new idea, but it's at least getting more mainstream scientific traction now, that the mind, all these things that we view as, that's in the brain. The brain's separate from the body, right? Which sounds ridiculous to say now, but several years ago, it wasn't at all ridiculous. Where these things, stress and anxiety and depression, we're all separate from the rest of the body. Now we can draw very, very bold arrows from those brain things into other parts of the body, you know, to the stomach, to the intestines, to the heart, to everything else. And there's a couple of ways that those signals get to the other parts of the body, right? So how does that stress of the bill or the traffic jam or the family issue get to your intestine and cause irritable bowel syndrome or Crohn's or whatever else? Well, lots of ways. First of all, there's the fact that it's hardwired. This is one of the reasons that stress can so quickly impact immune system function, because there's a hard wire, a literal hard wire from your brain, this computer in your head, to an important part of your immune system that resides in your gut called the Peyer's patches. Right, so right there, there's the stress. Boom! You just got a signal to your gut, just like that, to stimulate your immune system. If that signal happens over and over again, you'll actually have a suppression of your immune system function. Part of that suppressive effect comes through the endocrine system. So your brain also tells glands in your body to make certain hormones, upregulate some, downregulate others. So we have a hardwire system. We have a drip system. And it all comes back through the immune system. A lot of the work that our lab does now is not just stress and hormones and mood state, which is mostly what I'll talk about for the later slides, but we've also done a series of studies where we've looked at stress and hormone metabolism and immune system function. And we find that if we can get immune system function to become unsuppressed, which it gets suppressed under conditions of chronic stress, that can actually help people feel better, irrespective of whether they're sick or not. So we started the research out thinking, well, you know what? If we can keep people from getting sick, Well, of course they'll feel better, or at least they'll feel better compared to the people who are sick, right? That makes logical sense, right? If you're well, you're going to have a better mood state than if you're sick. And people who are sick, have a cold or a flu or a scratchy throat or whatever, their mood state logically would be lower. But what we found was, irrespective of your level of infection, you know, whether you're sick or not, or the degree of your infection, you know, severe symptoms versus mild symptoms, irrespective of that, if you modulate immune system function, you can have a beneficial effect on mood state. All right, and we're still trying to tease out exactly what's intervening there. Is it a neural thing? Is it a hormonal thing? What? But we know with people with better immune system function feel better, in terms of better mood, less depression, those sorts of things. So all that can impact your health. And mostly what we're going to talk about here is stress, and specifically chronic stress. Okay, so what are these sources of stress? It's not just the stress that we encounter every day. It's not just the baboon social hierarchy kind of stuff. And it's not just your bills and traffic and deadlines. That's a big piece of it. But I like to step off from that and let people know it's a lot more than what they may think. And I like to do that because if I'm doing a public seminar, right? Let's say that this were an informational seminar. We were trying to recruit people into one of our intervention studies. It's very predictive. We'll advertise for it. We'll say we're looking for people with moderate levels of psychological stress. We're going to be doing an immune system study, or we're going to be doing an antidepressant study, or we're going to be doing a weight loss study, or whatever it is. So we always recruit people with moderate levels of psychological stress. And when they come in, that you can see the eyes rolling around the audience. When I talk about stress, a lot of people automatically want to shut you out. Because why? If you say to, yeah?
They have too much.
They have too much, and what else? They have so much, they're overwhelmed, they're almost defeated a lot of times when you say to them, you know what, stress is bad for you, and you got to control your stress, and you got to get it under control. And people go, are you kidding me? They're almost speechless. They don't even know where to sit. Well, sometimes they're not speechless. Sometimes they'll tell you exactly where you can go and what you can do when you get there. And so I like to quickly step off from that and say, you know what, stress, blah, 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 but wait, the reason stress is bad for you is because this hormone goes up and this hormone goes down and this neurotransmitter gets unbalanced with that other neurotransmitter. And that, at least in the work that I do, that draws them in a little bit, because that's something a little more concrete to somebody. And I don't know why that is. I don't know if, you know, the pharmaceutical industry has educated us about cholesterol and there's something that causes heart disease and whatever, but at least I find with the studies that we do, once we tell people, you know what, stress, blah, 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 all these bad things, but wait, it's because of these hormone changes, and this study is going to measure those hormone changes, try to put them back where they need to be, that for some reason is very empowering to people. Okay, so that's a lot of what we talk about in our programs, cortisols and testosterones and those sorts of things. But I like to let people know how important it is and how crucial it is right now for them to get that under control. So they have emotional stress. That's sort of a given. Everybody has that. But a lot of people also have physical stress, right? We can consider aging a physical stress. How many people in here are aging? Okay, unfortunately, I don't have anything for that. But aging is a physical stress. I'll show you a graph right now with the two hormones that we measure most predominantly in our studies, how they change over the course of aging. Sleep deprivation is a physical stress. How many people in here get less than 8.5 hours of sleep every night? Almost everybody. Yeah, typically 80% of the hands will go up, because that's what the statistics show. 80% of people get less than what the National Sleep Foundation says is what we're supposed to get, which is 8.5 hours. I can't remember the last time I get 8.5 hours of sleep. But that, my recommendation there is, sure, yeah, if you can get 8.5 hours of sleep, excellent. Do that. Get that. That's wonderful. But most people can't, or most people don't want to, or most people try and fail, or whatever. There's lots of reasons why people don't get enough sleep. But if you're sleep deprived, let's take that 8.5 hours. If that's what we're supposed to get, and we compare the hormone profiles of people who get 8.5, and then we compare what the average sleep intake, I guess you kind of are intaking that sleep, but the average sleep that people get, which is what? Does anyone know what the average hours is? 6.5 is what the national average is right now. So the difference between that, 2 hours of lost sleep, or 2 hours of missed sleep, is a 50% overexposure to one stress hormone called cortisol, right? So just that, just the fact that you got, that you didn't get, that you lost or missed 2 hours of sleep means you have 50% more cortisol than somebody who got enough sleep, okay? Big deal, except that that 50% more cortisol in on that day is now going to change your appetite, right? So you're craving carbohydrates and sweets and sugars more. That 50% more cortisol is going to interfere with insulin function, so your blood sugar levels are fluctuating throughout the day, which is one of the reasons for your change in appetite. That 50% more cortisol, because it's interfering with insulin, and that's interfering with blood sugar control, and that's changing your appetite, is basically putting you in a pre-diabetic state just because you lost 2 hours of sleep. Right? So that's the importance of these various kinds of stressors. That, you know, little changes like that, or what we perceive as little changes, can sort of snowball to become big health outcomes, detrimental health outcomes, as we go down. Exercise can be both a physical benefit and a physical stress. Some of our very, very early work, and I'll talk about this in a second, was in athletes. I do a lot of work at the Olympic Training Centers, U.S. Ski Team, U.S. Track and Field Association, where what we look at is a very particular hormone disruption in athletes, too much cortisol, too little testosterone. So that imbalance between what we call the C cortisol to T testosterone ratio, when it's disrupted, those athletes are overtrained. But we see that same hormone disruption in people who are sleep deprived, people who are emotionally stressed, people who are under all these different, people who are dieting, you know, cutting their calories for weight loss. So we see that same central hormone disruption lots and lots of places. And so in an athlete situation, even though it's a very niche sort of market, niche target group, the idea for them with overtraining is to get them out of that disrupted state. And people who are listening to this recording can't see me holding my hands apart, but cortisol's up and testosterone is down. If we can get them back into balance, they're not overtrained anymore. When they are overtrained, they're getting sick, and they're getting hurt, and their performance is dropping, and they're gaining a little bit of weight. You know, so one of these Olympic athletes might go from you know, 2% body fat to 4% body fat, right? And most people will go, well, 4% body fat, sign me up, right? I'll take that. I'll take 4% body fat any of the day of the week. But just think about that from the athlete's perspective. They just increased their body fat percentage by 100% because they were overtrained, because their hormones changed, because they had these biochemical disruptions. Okay, so lots and lots of places where we can become stressed or imbalanced in our bodies. Environmental stress. I just read an article in the New York Times yesterday on the way here that nationally about 20% of us are drinking contaminated water, right? And sometimes it's contaminated, sometimes it's not. It kind of fluctuates. But, you know, those kinds of statistics, even if you're filtering your water, really make a big difference. Heat and cold. I talked to the woman from Minnesota. That's a stress. Living in Minnesota and having it -1 when you leave to come to South Carolina. Non-optimal diet. I won't talk too much about that. I would love to as a nutritionist, but you know, the standard American diet, right? You all know what that stands for, right? SAD, yeah, standard American diet is a sad state right now. I'll give you a quick plug for a really good obesity movie. I was the executive producer last year for a movie called Killer at Large. You can see a wonderful trailer on it for free if you go to killeratlarge.com. And it talks about the American obesity epidemic, the fact that partly it's diet, partly it's advertising, partly it's too many Big Macs and Coca-Colas and things like that, but partly it's just the fact that we're too busy, we're sleep deprived, we have these hormone disruptions caused by chronic stress. So it's more of a holistic take on why we're becoming fatter as a society than just talking about McDonald's and Coca-Cola. So you know, the moral of this, I guess, is that these sources of imbalance or stress, if we want to use that label, are internal, they're external, they're everywhere, and they're unavoidable. So people have to do something about it. And whether that means stress management course or a biofeedback intervention or a yoga class or exercise or eating better or whatever, you need to do something. You need to do something. I've yet to meet somebody that doesn't have at least some of that. You know, and a lot of times people will sit in the audience and go, yeah, I got that. Yep, got that one too. You know, they get to the end, they're like, yes, perfect score. And you go, no, that's not a perfect score. That's bad because you have all these overlapping, intervening sources of stress in your body. So you really need to do something about it. And I already mentioned this. We started this work, this series of work, over the last 5, 6, maybe 7 years now. We started it in athletes, looking at these elite-level athletes and their very particular hormone disruption that they had when they were overtrained. And that was great. We put that research on the shelf for a couple of years. But what we found very quickly, that this same biochemical disruption in athletes was the same one that we saw in dieters. It was the same one we saw in short sleepers, which are those, you know, people who are missing 2 hours of sleep. It's the same people we saw in just the moderately stressed people. We have a one-page stress screener that we'll generally use for people to find out. When we recruit people for studies, we don't want them to be low stress. We want them to be at least moderately stressed so that they're likely to have these hormone disruptions and they're likely to have immune system suppression so that we can see a change in the interventions that we're going to do. Do you think it's hard for us to recruit those people? No, it's the easiest studies in the world to recruit for because there's such a pool of people out there that are at least moderately stressed. But what we found was same biochemical disruptions, same psychological outcomes. All of these people who have these kinds of stress in their lives have the same hormone disruptions, cortisol up, testosterone low. They have the same psychological manifestation of that, meaning they're all a little bit depressed, they're all a little bit fatigued, they're all a little bit irritable and tense, and they have low vigor, which I'll talk about in a little bit. And then if you can restore that biochemistry through whatever means, there's lots of ways to do it, which I guess is the good news part of the talk. Lots of ways to get yourself back into balance. Once you do that, you see significant improvements in their depression index or their stress index or their fatigue index. And I'll show you some of that data in a little bit. So the same benefits to restoring that biochemical balance. Are there any questions so far? Okay. So we start out kind of with a mentality, that's probably not the right word, but a baseline of the people in our studies are tired, stressed, depressed. That's their starting point. Population-wise, that's probably 80% of everybody. They're stressed out by different things, but they have the same biochemical disruption. They have the same sort of, mood portrayal of that. They're starting out tired, stressed, depressed. That's sort of a shorthand. The people that we're recruiting are moderately stressed, but they're also low in a psychological measurement called vigor. Has anybody ever heard of that term before? Psychological vigor. People will sometimes, it sounds kind of old-fashioned, right? Old-fashioned word. Vim and vigor, you've heard that terminology before from the 1950s. Vigor is a psychological research term that refers to a three-tiered mood state. So when I say tired, stressed, depressed, it's somebody with low vigor. You know the opposite of vigor, actually. Burnout. You've heard of burnout before, right? Burnout is also a word from psychology research that, for whatever reason, has made it over into the popular vocabulary. So somebody, if they're tired, stressed, depressed, if they're just worn out, they'll say, I'm burned out, right? So people will use that as a word. The opposite of burnout is vigor. So we typically measure vigor, but we can also measure burnout, and they're just the opposites of each other. Vigor is a mood state. I'll define for you in just a second. I want to wait for it for a second. So if we're tired, stressed, depressed, right, which is lots and lots of people, probably 80% of the American population, what do? We go to the doctor. Are there any physicians in here? Okay. When I give a nutrition seminar, the audience is very often wanting me to come up and bash physicians and bash the pharmaceutical industry and say, these bad drugs, these bad physicians. But I have a lot of friends who are physicians, and I want to try to defend their position, right? Somebody's tired, stressed, depressed. Somebody has low vigor. Somebody has lots of stress. They go in to see their doc, right? And they say, doc, I'm tired, stressed, depressed. I'm exhausted. I'm whatever label that they put on it from their own vocabulary. The doctor stands there and goes, well, I don't have anything for that. I don't have anything for that. That, you know, there's no drug that treats low vigor. There's no drug that treats burnout. There's no drug that treats what you just described to that physician. And so what they have is they have this. They have antidepressants, right? The number one most prescribed class of medications separate from cholesterol medications, right? And I'm not the type of person that's going to stand up here and tell you that these are these are ineffective interventions, because they certainly have effects. They're certainly wonderful for some people. But if you look from a stress standpoint, from a chronic stress, low vigor standpoint, probably half of all people who are being prescribed these medications don't need them. Or they're being prescribed something for a condition that's a mismatch. Okay, so if you're depressed and you need something to increase your serotonin, there's lots of things that'll do that. Some of these drugs do a combination of serotonin, norepinephrine, and things like that. But my message here is less that these are ineffective. They're certainly on the target, right? If we talk about the target being some sort of efficacy, they're on the target, but they're not on the bullseye of what I'm talking to you about right now, chronic stress and low vigor, right? If you want to get to the bullseye, there's other ways to do that than these. If these aren't going to do it for you, then you have, again, picture yourself as that doctor, all right? Here's my toolkit. I've got these antidepressants over here. I've got these sleep medications over there. I've got some ADD drugs over there. You know, so a lot of times what people describe when they're in that chronic stress standpoint, they describe sleep problems. They describe concentration problems. They describe being depressed. But none of these interventions get to the biochemistry of that stress response. Okay, they do things in the body, but they don't get to that bullseye, as I said before. All right, you don't go to the doctor, right? Or you go to the doctor and you don't get the satisfaction that you're looking for, right? Those drugs don't do what you hoped they would, right? So then we start self-medicating. We self-medicate with Red Bulls and Rock Stars and Monsters and things like that. Does anybody know how much, just in the U.S. alone, how much those drinks sell dollar-wise every year? A lot. Yeah, a real lot. $5 billion just in the energy drinks. That's not counting, Mountain Dew isn't an energy drink. It's just a regular soft drink, right? So Coca-Cola's and Mountain Dew's and Sprites and those sorts of things are separate from the $5 billion of just those little cans, those little energy drink cans, right? So we self-medicate with that. We self-medicate with coffee and things like that. And I'm not saying these are bad, right? I'm a user of the ones that you just saw come up. Coffees and things like that. You know, at least there I can say to somebody, you know what? When you take caffeine into your body on top of your stress, does anybody know what it does? You have somebody who's stressed, and you can show them what their hormones look like, and then you apply caffeine on top of that stress, it raises cortisol even more. Yeah, and the cut point, the tipping point, seems to be about 200 milligrams, right? So I'll tell people, you know, a practical recommendation for people is not to quit coffee. The practical recommendation is to try to shut it off at 2 cups, okay? Because that really does seem to be, there seems to be no detrimental effect hormonally, cortisol overexposure, up to about 200 milligrams of caffeine, okay? So, yeah.
Is there any data, similar data for
Ritalin and classical stimulants? That's a good question. If you couldn't hear her, she asked, if there's the same sort of data for Ritalin and other types of stimulants, do they increase cortisol? And I don't know. The caffeine effect seems to be more pronounced when we're under stress. If you took somebody who's low stress, you know, sort of cool cucumber kind of a person, you can give them lots more caffeine before you see a cortisol effect. If you have somebody that's already stressed and you give them caffeine, that bump in cortisol overexposure happens quicker, happens earlier. Happens at a lower dose. Another question?
Is it the same with tea also?
Any kind of caffeine. She asked if it was the same as tea. So most of some of those studies are coffee interventions where they know how much caffeine is in that cup, but some of them are just they give pure caffeine. But I don't think I've ever seen a study that's used tea as the intervention, but I would suspect you'd see the same thing. Except for, does anybody know what's in green tea that helps you not get jittery from the caffeine? You know, somebody could drink 100 milligrams of caffeine in coffee and feel jittery. I mean, just, you know, you get energized, but you get a little bit and anxious. You could drink 100 milligrams of caffeine in tea and just get the energy, but not get the jitteriness. Does anyone know why that is? There's also something in tea leaves, which you're extracting when you pour hot water onto these tea leaves, called theanine. It's an amino acid that's naturally occurring there, and theanine is a very nice relaxation ingredient. We've used it in some of our studies. We give it to people pure, and it gives them a very nice relaxation effect. Not a sleep effect like a melatonin or a valerian or something like that, but a very nice focused alertness, relaxed kind of a feeling. And that's a nice benefit. Here's this natural product, these green tea leaves or black tea leaves. It's in all forms of tea that doesn't counteract the effects of caffeine, but evens it out in some ways. Yeah. I'm sorry? How do you spell that? How do you spell theanine? So it's on a future slide, but it's theanine, theanine. And you can buy it, you know, if you're drinking green tea, you're getting some of it. If you buy green tea supplements, as long as it's not a decaf. If you decaffeinate a green tea supplement, you lose most of the theanine. I'll talk about theanine in a little bit. Yeah. Does it have to be green tea or can it be black tea? Black tea also has theanine, but it's less theanine in black tea than in green tea. Okay, and there's actually a little bit more theanine in white tea. So the younger, if you're a tea drinker, if you're a tea aficionado, there's all sorts of tea you can buy. There's black, there's green, there's white, there's younger leaves, there's older leaves. Younger leaves, if this is somebody who drinks a lot of tea, younger green tea leaves have more theanine than older ones. The theanine actually gets converted into something over the life of the plant called catechins, which are good for other things. I'll talk about that too. Okay, so lots and lots of ways that we're self-medicating ourselves out of this tired, stressed, depressed situation to the tune of more than $80 billion. That's a pretty conservative number. If we add up the antidepressant prescriptions and we add up the and this doesn't include the ADD medications, it would be another $5 billion on top of that. Okay, so lots and lots of expenditures, people trying to find a way out of this situation of tired, stressed, depressed. Okay. Does anybody know what these are? What's that? Yeah, they're neurons. They're nerve cells. Specifically, these are brain cells. They're neurons. Remember the slide I put up that showed all those different stress-related diseases and how many studies there are in humans showing chronic stress, you know, biochemical disruption, detrimental health outcome. One of the reasons for all of those different kinds of detrimental health outcomes, whether it's obesity or diabetes or mental problems or immune system dysfunction, whatever, is because that biochemical disruption that stress causes, too much cortisol, too little testosterone, that disruption in C-to-T ratio, leads to tissue breakdown, accelerated tissue breakdown in every single tissue in the body, every single one. So here we've got dead brain cells. We've got on the left-hand side, normal stress. This is a situation where your C-to-T ratio would be balanced. You have a large neuron. It's the neuronal body is thick. The projections that you see, there are many projections. They're long. In a mouse, this is from a mouse. It's hard to get humans to donate their neurons to your research studies. But in a mouse, at least, this would be a mouse that could find the cheese. Right? They could get through the maze very quickly. They could get a good score in terms of their time. The next time they could find it even quicker because they would remember it and they would have good recall, all those sorts of things. You know, if you could measure it in a mouse, this mouse would be happy. It would be creative. It would be good problem solving. It would be a good listener. It would be, you know, do all kinds of wonderful things. In a high stress situation, though, you can put that a mouse, a human, any creature in a high stress situation, chronic stress situation, and first you see a functional impairment, right? When we talk about memory, so memory will become less robust. You won't be able to recall quite as quickly. You won't be able to lay down memories quite as well. Your creativity will suffer. Your mood will suffer. All sorts of things happen to the brain, and then eventually you see a physical degradation. So functional impairment comes early. Physical degradation might take some time. But you can see it. And what you see is, in a high-stress situation, those neurons, or any tissue, will actually physically break down faster. You have an increase in catabolism, right? Breakdown in the tissue. So the neuronal body gets smaller. It gets thinner. The projections that you see are fewer. The ones that are there are thinner. Some of them are actually physically broken. So you can see that in a mouse. You can see it on a CT scan in a human. There's some good studies in flight attendants and long-haul pilots, you know, who are doing international, you know, round-the-globe kinds of flights. So they're stressed. They're sleep deprived. They're not eating right. They're doing all sorts of things that are leading them to these biochemical disruptions, and you can actually see a physical degradation of the memory centers of the parts of the brain that are involved in memory. Right? That's scary stuff. That the stress that we're under is causing our brains to shrink, right? Literally, not just perform poorly, but actually physically break down faster. And the question there, unfortunately, we don't have an answer to. The question there is, does that come back? If you remove that stress or restore that balance in the body, can those brain centers come back to where they were before? Does anybody have an idea about that? But it takes a long time, which is the problem. Excuse me. I've had people say, no, that'll never come back because neurons don't grow back. And that used to be the predominant thinking maybe 20 years ago. But now we know that they do grow back. They just grow back very, very slowly. Okay, so this can happen quickly, but to get to a restored state, back to your normal baseline, it's going to take some time.
There is some evidence.
Okay, she said, for people who couldn't hear, she said there's
certain ones
which will remain. So psychotropic drugs increasing the number of dendritic productions. New ones or restoring ones that were lost from?
Restoring
ones that were there before. Okay, so this is your brain, right? Your brain's shrinking in response to stress, response to these disruptions. Does anybody know what this is? It's not a brain scan, but I tricked you because the first one was from brain. What part of the body is this? It's a CT scan of your abdomen. Yeah, right at the level of the belly button. And these are two different people, right? It's not like a before after kind of thing. This is abdominal obesity. And what you see, same sort of thing. Left-hand side, normal stress situation. Right-hand side, high stress situation. And what I've done is colorized the intra-abdominal fat. You can see both of these. You can see that this subject, the high stress subject, has more subcutaneous fat also, you know, pinch an inch kind of fat. But they have a lot more of that yellow kind of fat. It's not really yellow, but it's been colorized so you can see it. Why is the person, they're both women, well, importantly, they're both women, and they're both 30% body fat. Yeah, surprising. How in the world, this one makes sense, right? 30% body fat. There it is. You can see it. Where's the 30% body fat in this person? Hips, legs, thighs, buttocks, big toe, who cares, right? It's someplace that's not their abdomen. Why is that right-hand side one so bad? Well, they have high cortisol, which led to that. But now what's this going to lead to? Heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, syndrome X, basically. This person's going to die sooner than this person, on average. Okay, because of that stress caused these biochemical disruptions, led to a preferential deposition of fat in that belly fat region. We don't know why that happens, but we know specifically belly fat is stress fat. We can do that research in animals. I've done that research in animals where, you know, you can jingle your keys over the mouse cages, you know, all day long and make these mice really stressed out, or rats, and give them a nice yummy rat diet, you know, the rat equivalent of a Big Mac diet. And everybody gains weight, right? But the ones that are under the most stress gain weight abdominally. They gain belly fat. And you can't even get your hands around these poor little guys to pick them up, to study them after a while. But the same thing happens in humans. It happens in Sapolsky's baboons. It happens throughout the animal kingdom. So your brain is shrinking. Your belly is growing when you're under stress, right? When we're under stress, because it's happening to all of us. Here's that aging effect. And we can show this. We can show the same sort of graph in response to all various sorts of stress. It's neat to look at from an aging perspective because you can look over years and years and years. There are only two hormones that go up as we age. One's cortisol. Does anyone know what the other one is? Insulin. And the reason insulin goes up is some of the same reasons that cortisol goes up. When cortisol gets high, it interferes with insulin activity. So your body has to produce more and more and more to get an effect. As we age, our bodies lose sensitivity to both cortisol and insulin, meaning our body can't register that we've produced it, so So we have to produce a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And that's bad for both of those hormones. Overexposure to insulin is bad from a heart disease standpoint. Overexposure to cortisol is bad from a heart disease standpoint, but also from some of these other standpoints that I mentioned before. And it all starts to happen right around our mid-30s. Okay, so most of us are a couple of years past that. And what you see is testosterone starts to slowly drop about 1% per year after age 30 or so, mid-30s, and cortisol starts to rise about 1% per year after the mid-30s or so. And eventually you get to a point where they cross, where you have more cortisol, not in a milligram level, but from a balance standpoint, you'll get to a tipping point where you have too much cortisol and too little testosterone. And it happens in men and women. It's important to understand that testosterone is very, very important for a female body. Maybe in some ways, at least from an aging perspective, more important than for a male's body. When we talk to women about, hey, we're going to bring you into this study, we're going to try to modulate some of your hormones, one of which is testosterone, you'll get a little bit of standoffish from women. They'll say, my testosterone, keep your hands off my testosterone, right? It's fine right where it is. Because their thinking is, that's a man's hormone. I don't need that. I don't want that. I don't want that to change. But a female's body, even though a female's body makes about 10 times less testosterone than a man's body does, that makes it even more important for her to maintain that normal level over time. Because if it drops even just a little bit, you'll very rapidly and very dramatically see the impact of that, which is depression and muscle loss and bone loss and mood swings and all those sorts of things, okay? So this balance between these two hormones, and these two hormones in particular are counter-regulatory to each other. So when cortisol goes up in response to stress, testosterone typically goes down, all right? There's a question? Yeah, there are. So her question was all about menopause, right? And I totally understand where you are, right? There's a joke in stress research. It's not a funny joke, but there's a joke about how women's bodies change in response to either menopause or stress, where you go from this hourglass shape to more of a shot glass shape, right? I told you it wasn't very funny. But it happens. And one of the reasons for that is that when your body loses estrogen or starts to become, not loses it, but starts to become less... producing less estrogen in lots of ways, either producing it less regularly or shutting off completely. Estrogen in a lot of ways protects from some of the detrimental effects of cortisol. So your cortisol could be exactly the same as where it was. It's probably, if you're average, your cortisol level's moderately high. It's not where it should be, but it's probably not out of normal ranges. So your cortisol level's moderately high, your estrogen's protecting from some of those detrimental effects, one of which is abdominal belly fat deposition. So you lose that estrogen, cortisol now can have its big effect from a body composition standpoint, which is to tell your brain you're hungry, specifically for carbohydrates and sweets, and then when you eat those foods, to store them in your belly fat region. So it's kind of a combination thing. Is it the fact that your estrogen is going away? Is it the fact that your testosterone has probably dropped too? Is it the fact that your cortisol is either a little bit higher now or it's the same and now it's not being sort of shielded, the effects of it being shielded by estrogen? It's all of that. And so, even when I talk about cortisol and testosterone being so important to balance, there's really a cascade effect here where, you can balance somebody's cortisol, but if you don't do something to their testosterone also, you're not going to get the effects that you want. If you balance both of those, you might also get an effect on insulin. If you just tried to balance somebody's insulin and then they went under stress, you'd get a downstream effect. So you're always getting this back and forth crosstalk between all of these hormones. So with endocrine research, it's very hard to say, it's this one that you need to modulate, because modulating one of those is going to change some others. Yeah, that's a great idea. If people want to ask questions, if you wouldn't mind, I'll repeat them if you want me to, but if you want to get your real question on, use the mic. That'd be great.
Well, I think that I felt dismissed because he used the term, well, it's a mini pot. All women at your age start getting this little mid. And I said, well, I don't think that's acceptable because are there things I can do about it versus this is my fate and whatever.
Right.
And so I think, I would have liked to have known more, and maybe I'll go back and think about from just my own personal levels of hormones, what I can do to maybe enhance, what I'm doing for myself.
Yeah, and it's the reason you got that answer is because the doctor, with apologies to our physician colleagues here, most docs have 5 minutes to spend with you, mm-hmm. right? And so that's going to be a problem, right? It's taken me an hour and 6 minutes to explain everything that I explained to you right now. Your physician doesn't have that kind of time to talk to you about hormones and this one and that one and how they balance and how there's a cascade effect and things like that. So just now, we haven't even got to some of our intervention data, but just now you understand there's an estrogen effect going on in your body, there's a cortisol effect, there's a testosterone effect, there's probably a bunch of other different effects too. And you can get those all into balance, but it's going to take some work on your part, not just somebody saying, you know what, here's the thing, prescription.
Right.
Okay?
Thanks.
Okay, so all that leads us back to this, the tired, stressed, depressed person.
What are your thoughts on bioidentical hormone therapy?
Yeah, but you know, bioidentical hormone therapy is, I like it in a lot of ways. It's going to be a long answer. Come talk to me about that after. I would be happy to talk to you about bioidenticals. I like bioidenticals, but bioidenticals in a lot of ways, in some ways, aren't that much different to some of the what you might view as non-bioidenticals, right? Bioidenticals are a big rage right now. They're very, very popular, but they've been around for a long time. And there's certainly pros and cons to some of the horse urine hormones too. Mostly cons, but there's some pros there too. I can talk to you about after. Yes,
so,
ma'am.
So what about progesterone in relationship to testosterone?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how does that work
as
you get older?
Estrogen and progesterone, you know, the sort of menopausal hormones, are a different side of the house from what I'm talking about. What I talk about, cortisol, testosterone, I refer more to as metabolic hormones. So when we measure estrogen and progesterone in our studies, and they don't change in response to these interventions, which is good that I'm able to study these sort of with, not with blinders on, but I'm able to study these in kind of a pure state. If I stress changes these hormones, I apply an intervention, the hormones rebalance, mood state changes, those sorts of things, irrespective of those menopausal hormones. That's good from a research standpoint. It's bad from a standpoint of all these questions about menopause, right? A lot of times I'll talk about hormone balancing, and menopausal women will want to say, great, I'll take that. I need some hormone balancing right now. But those are different hormones where they might go a bioidentical route, they might go some other kind of hormone replacement therapy route that's separate from this kind of hormone balancing. Okay? So let's get back to our tired, stressed, depressed person. I won't spend too much time on these next two slides. Again, if you want these slides, I can send them to you because I don't think this is in the original deck that's on the website. This one is? Okay. I mentioned before that cortisol and testosterone are counter-regulatory to each other. When cortisol goes up, testosterone typically goes down. And we did a lot of research where we were very much focused on cortisol. If we can get somebody's cortisol back down, when I say down, I mean it's typically high normal, and we want to get it back down to normal. If we can get that back down, we'll get some wonderful effects. You know, we can get belly fat loss, we can get better blood sugar control, we can get drops in blood pressure, we can get improvements in mood state. But for a while, we weren't getting the effects that we thought we could get. We would see 15-20% drops in cortisols, and that was great. And it dawned on us a few years ago that what we needed to do is actively, when cortisol comes down, testosterone generally starts to rise. But it can sometimes be a lag of several months. And our studies typically are only about 12 weeks long. And so sometimes we were seeing cortisols come down, but testosterones didn't come back up unless we actively managed that. And so now what we do, instead of just focusing on cortisol, this whole idea of the cortisol connection, now we focus more on the balance between those two. Okay, seesaw kind of a mentality. So if your testosterone is low, or your cortisol is high, or what most people have is both, cortisol high and testosterone low, these are some of the things that you can expect in men and in women. Emotional changes, I'll show you a whole deck of different mood state changes. More fatigue, less sex drive, less muscle mass, reduced metabolic rate, increased abdominal fat, all of which are going to impact on your risk of becoming obese or gaining weight in the midsection, weak bones, back pain, elevated cholesterol. And we've seen benefits in all of these areas by renormalizing those hormones. And here you can see a list of what happens if you balance those hormones back with each other. That means, typically, that means getting cortisol levels down a little bit, and it means getting testosterone levels back up a little bit, which is really just a restoration of the balance that you should have had before that chronic stress upset the apple cart, if you will. Okay? So I won't go through all of those because they're basically the opposite of the slide previous. The big area of my research right now is this area of vigor. You can see it in red capital letters on this. Vigor is, and I think I define it on the next slide. It's a psychological mood state. I talked a little bit about it before. And the definition of it is this. It's a three-tiered mood state characterized by physical energy, mental acuity, and emotional well-being, all in the same measurement. So our tired, stressed, depressed subjects typically have a very low vigor score. So depression is separate from this, and fatigue is separate from this, and stress is separate from this. The reason I'm excited about this is not a lot of people know about it from a public standpoint. It's not, as I mentioned before, it's not a word that's sort of made its way from research over into the public vocabulary. But when people feel this, they are absolutely amazed. When you can take somebody from a state of low vigor, where most people are, 80% of people are right now, and bring them back to a stage of not boosted vigor, but bringing them from suppressed back up to normal, it's life-changing for a lot of these people. It's a little bit humorous to watch them try to describe it. Because in our nutrition intervention studies, we'll have a room full of people like this, and we'll have whatever our intervention is. It's a diet and exercise program. It's a supplementation regimen. It's a weight loss program. It's a stress management course. Whatever it is, there's some sort of an intervention where we measure people's vigor at the beginning, and then we measure it at time points throughout the study. And every week we get together, we have a nutrition lecture or a hormone lecture or whatever, and people will describe sort of what they're feeling. And it's a riot to watch them and listen to them try to struggle with the words, because they don't have this, most of them don't have this word vigor in their vocabulary. That doesn't mean anything to them. In a room full of psychology researchers, it means something. But in a room full of people who just felt terrible before and feel better now, they don't have that word. So you can watch them describing, they'll go, well, yeah, I have more energy, and my mood is better, and my, you know, seems like I'm out of that mental fog that I was in before. And so they'll have pieces of it, right? They'll have little pieces of it. And I had one woman who said one time, she goes, you know, I just you could see her struggling with what the word was. And she went, yeah, some of the energy like that guy, and some of the mood like that lady over there. But, and she just gave up. She goes, I don't know. I just know I'm getting more vacuuming done. You know, and for her, it was a very unique, you know, almost like motivation that she felt like before she was in this quagmire, and now with her vigor restored to not boosted, restored to where it should have been before she got in this state of stress, she felt a heck of a lot better, and she was getting more things done. So, you know, I like to share that story because it's, you know, the those kinds of things aren't just, you know, we can measure statistical significant in our interventions, and I'll show you some of those charts. But for a lot of these people, those are very meaningful, you know, almost in some cases life-changing kinds of benefits for them. Okay, so as I mentioned before, I'm a nutritionist, and when I look for interventions to change things like vigor, I like a lot. My laboratory does a lot of herbal product development too. Our lab's based just south of Salt Lake City. I don't know if you guys know this, but almost every herbal product in this country comes from Utah. Almost every single nutrition company is based right there. So the vast majority of my clients that we do product development for or research studies for on their herbals are right there in our... USANA's there. Yep, USANA is there. New Skin is there. Zango is there. Schiff is there. Everybody is there. And all the ingredient suppliers are there and all the manufacturers are there. So... a lot of the work that we do has some sort of an herbal intervention, whether it's green tea and theanine, like I mentioned before, or some of the others that I'll talk about. But we look to traditional medicine around the world. A lot of TCM, traditional Chinese medicine, but if you look at traditional medicine systems in any country in the world, whether you look at China or India or Malaysia or South America, Brazilian medicine, any of those, they all have a tradition of improving vigor. Right? They don't call it vigor. They call it qi in China. They call it prana in Ayurvedic medicine. They call it, if you're a Jedi Knight, they call it life force, right? There's every single culture has their word for that idea of life force. And so, you know, scientists, you know, in my world, we call it vigor, and we're measuring the same thing. And this dawned on me about 10 years ago. I have some colleagues in China where they'll identify different herbs, and they'll say, this is what we know about it from a safety, a toxicity, traditional use standpoint, and then we'll take it and we'll apply some Western standards to it. You know, we'll measure mood state, we'll measure hormone profiles, we'll measure performance outcomes, whatever it is. And I was looking a bunch of years ago for something that helped control stress, right? This was very early in my work into this area. And so we would go back and forth looking for something for stress. You know, usually they get back very quickly to me. And these are literally people looking through dusty books. I mean, it literally in laboratories. They have the modern stuff too, but it's literally, okay, this is what they used 3,000 years ago. What's in that blend of 10 things? Let's start studying those different things. It's not just nutritionists. The pharmaceutical companies are doing this kind of work too. So they usually get back very quickly. This time I was looking for something for stress. No answers, nothing. And I had to go back and back and back. And finally they came back to me and said, we don't have anything. There's no stress. We don't have an entry for stress in our books, right? Because 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years ago in traditional Chinese medicine, there was no stress, right? As we view it, right? Psychological stress. They certainly had stress from parasites and famines and, you know, weather and floods and all those sorts of things, but they didn't have what I was asking for. And so as I described it, they went, oh, you're looking for something that restores the qi. And I went, oh, of course I am. You know, that for me 10 years ago was a big revelation that, hey, wait a minute, somebody's already been doing this research for not just a few years, but 5,000 years. You know, that's a lot of time. And so a lot of times we look to, you know, what some of these things are. So I'm not going to share a lot of data with you, you know, actual graphs and things like that, but I do want to share a subset so you can see what the magnitude of these sorts of changes look like if you can take somebody from that state of tired, stressed, depressed, or low vigor, or disrupted hormones, and rebalance them. And I'll explain what some of our interventions are. We've presented this work all over the place, some of the top nutrition conferences. And it's all geared around this idea of what you see here, improving mood state and metabolic parameters in stress subjects. So from my perspective as a nutritional biochemist, I really focus on the biochemistry of it, right? I say this kind of tongue-in-cheek, right? I don't care what the mental aspect is right now. What I'm looking at is, what happens if I modulate those hormones? What do I get in terms of an emotional outcome? How does that biochemistry drive the emotions? We've already talked a little bit about the fact that it's a two-way street. It goes both ways. But now I'm going to talk to you purely about change the biochemistry, change the psychology. Okay? These are some of the supplements that we've studied over the years, individually and in a whole bunch of different combinations. I won't go through all of them, but Uricoma, citrus peel, Camellia sinensis, which is the green tea we talked about before. There's the L-theanine. When we study in our lab, we give it to people pure because in the tea leaves, it fluctuates based on the age of the plant and the kind of production kind of extraction it's been under. Cordyceps, which is a mushroom, rhodiola, which is a root. Most of these are roots, but you know, we've got roots, we've got mushroom heads, we've got peels, we've got leaves, and all of them are extracted, and all of them are standardized, at least in our trials. They're not always standardized if you buy them out on the market, but we standardize them so we know what the ratio to actives and inactives are, so we have a sort of a consistent effect study to study to study. But they're all, you know, all of this work, whether we're using one of these or four of these or whatever the combination is, are geared towards this, maintaining metabolic hormone balance. So not the estrogens and the progesterones, those kinds of hormones that you asked about before, but these metabolic hormones. Cortisol to testosterone ratios, dopamine to norepinephrine ratios, and we also measure some things in our weight loss trials called HSD, which stands for hydroxysteroid dehydrogenase. The reason that we usually refer to this as a fat-storing hormone, but what it really does is if your HSD activity is really high, you're going to have a lot of cortisol, and specifically you're going to have a lot of cortisol in your belly fat cells, which means you're going to have a lot of abdominal fat. So this, look for this. If 5 years, 8 years from now, drugs that inhibit this enzyme will be the blockbuster drug. Because if you can inhibit this enzyme, you can help people with abdominal obesity, you can help them with diabetes, you can help them with high blood pressure. Okay, so every major pharmaceutical company in the world right now is trying to inhibit this. Amgen will probably be the first one because they're furthest along in their trials. But the idea is if you can inhibit this, you can balance this, you can help obesity and some of those outcomes, and that citrus peel, PMFs, does that. So we can do it naturally to a degree. It'll be done even more predominantly in these medications coming down the road. Hey.
Can we reduce HSD behaviorally without supplements or blockbuster drugs?
That's a great question. I don't think we can. Everything else on here you can, though. Behaviorally, we can do cortisol, testosterone. Behaviorally, we can do dopamine, norepinephrine. But behaviorally, this is an area that's not going to have an effect. Unfortunately, that's an area that you're either going to have to go to the supplements or you're going to have to go to a pharmaceutical so that you get that chemical effect at that tissue.
But if we lower cortisol, will we lower HSD?
No, that's not a two-way street, unfortunately. The question was, if you lower cortisol, does it have an effect on HSD? In fact, one of the problems with HSD is that it's such a central kind of an enzyme. When you diet, when you cut your calories back to lose weight, and you lose weight in the abdominal region, HSD activity goes up. So the body's fighting back from a biochemical standpoint by upregulating the activity of this enzyme so that you have more cortisol, so you're driven more to store that fat back where you just lost it from. So that's one of the many, many, many biochemical reasons why weight loss is so difficult for people. Okay, so I'm going to share just a subset of the data here. Across all the studies that we do, I mentioned before, we have a screener where we get moderately stressed subjects into our trials. This particular one, we had 50 subjects, 8 men, 42 women. We screened them for moderate levels of psychological stress. We follow them for 8 weeks. Our studies are generally 8 weeks to 12 weeks long in terms of our interventions. And the interventions that we do are sometimes all of this and sometimes a combination of this. It's a program that we call SENSE. It's a combination of stress management. That stress management is mostly, because we're a nutrition lab, it's mostly identifying what your stressors are and being mindful of when they present themselves and coming up with your own strategies for dealing with them. All right, so we'll do stress management, we'll do yoga, we'll do breathing, we'll do biofeedback. We have a range of exercise interventions, typically walking interval kinds of training. We do a wide variety of nutrition interventions, sometimes supplementation, and always evaluation, because one thing we want people to understand is that their stress, even though it's likely to be chronically elevated, it will come and go, right? There'll be a fluctuation to that. Whether it's a day-to-day fluctuation or it's a week-to-week, this is going to be a really bad week and this is going to be a less bad week. So we have them evaluate where they are on a weekly basis and then try to plan for what their regimen is going to look like in response to whatever stress they're going to be facing. Okay? And so all of that research really is encapsulated on this one slide, right? Almost every single study that we do looks just like this. The numbers change, but the general story is the same. If we balance the C to T ratio, cortisol to testosterone ratio, and it really seems to be that ratio that's more important than just your high cortisol or just your low testosterone, if we can get that from a p-value of a little bit over 3, which doesn't mean a lot, but if we can drop that by a little bit, in this case, 15% improvement, what we see reproducibly across these trials is that stress improves, people feel less stressed out, and global mood state improves. The way we measure mood state, global mood state is roughly analogous to an overall sense of well-being. We measure it using something called POMS. Does anybody know profile of mood states or have used it before? A couple people. It is probably the gold standard way to measure the effect of an intervention, right? So it's not diagnosing depression or diagnosing anxiety disorder or whatever else. It's showing a response to an intervention. It's very, very sensitive to that. So we balance the hormones 15%, reduce stress 14%, improve well-being 22%. That's a pretty big change, actually. A 22% improvement in global mood state is, like I was mentioning before, it's statistically significant. But for these people experiencing it, it's very, very meaningful. You got a question?
Yeah. Simple question.
Yeah.
I know your program is coming to an end. What foods, what specific foods did you emphasize in your nutritional therapy?
Yeah, I can answer that quickly. Our nutrition intervention is not always, but mostly this. People are eating a certain way, and we'll tell them, whatever you're doing, whether you think it's working for you or not, stop doing that and do this. And we have something that we call the helping hand. We have them hold up their hand like this, their palm spread wide, their fingers spread wide. That's their fruits and vegetables, right? Not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but that's how much it is on their plate, how much space it takes up on their plate. So you have to eat this volume of fruits and vegetables, breakfast, lunch, dinner. Then we have them close their fist, make a tight fist. That's their concentrated carbohydrates. So that's things like pasta and bread and oatmeal and cereal and things like that. So when you go to Olive Garden, you have, and they bring you that gigantic bowl of pasta that's bigger than your head, right? You do this with your fist, and you scoop that amount to the side, and you take the rest home in a doggy bag, right? So that's your concentrated carbs. Then the size of your palm is your protein. So that's, you know, that's a chicken breast, that's tofu, that's a fish fillet, that's whatever it is. Doesn't matter how thick it is, right? So you can have a nice filet mignon if you want to, a nice thick thing, about a facing of your palm. What do you get served at the restaurant? You get served one that's this big, right? You know, a lot bigger than your palm, more like a catcher's mitt kind of a thing. All right, so that's your protein, and this is your added fat, an okay sign, right? And we insist that people take all of that. So that's olive oil or butter or full-fat salad dressing or some cream in the morning on your oatmeal. All of that, you know, hand, palm, fist, okay sign, for most people is about 500 calories. Breakfast, 500 calories lunch, 500 calories dinner. So that 1,500 calories that they end up eating helps control their blood sugar, helps control their cortisol, makes them feel full all day long, and takes away something that's really, really important that I haven't talked about but is a central aspect to our nutrition program, which is it reduces their dietary restraint, right? So most people are very concerned about what they eat. They think that if I eat that, it's going to make me gain weight. If I eat that, it's not good for me. If I eat that, whatever. This takes this hand method takes that away. You're not counting calories. You're not counting carb grams. You're not counting fat grams, anything like that. So it makes it very easy for people to follow. Okay. So that's the nutrition plan that we recommend to most people. Okay. Let me take you through this real quick, and then I'm gonna wrap up. The thing that I like about the Profile of Mood States tool is that you can get a global mood state number, a well-being number, which is great, but you can also drill down to all these different subscales and find out what's driving that global mood state number. So in this particular 8-week intervention that we did, we had a 22% improvement in global mood state, which is great, but what are the other subscales looking like? Tension's going down significantly. Fatigue and depression are both being cut in half, which is great. This depression is a mood state depression. It's not saying we're taking somebody who's clinically depressed and we're, you know, curing that disease. We're really just changing that mood state of depression, which is different from, you know, somebody with depression might have some fatigue. Somebody with a low state of vigor or a high state of burnout might have some of these other things, but they're different mood states. And sometimes we'll see all of them change, sometimes we'll see only some of them change. The vigor one is really where we're focusing most of our research right now, because that 27% improvement in vigor that we found in this 8-week trial is, as I said before, statistically significant, which is nice. It shows us that it's not an accidental effect or an artifact of some sort. But that is literally life-changing for these people. To come from that state of low vigor, we might as well call that quagmire, right? Those people are literally, they're stressed and they're tired and they're fatigued and they're all those things that we would describe, but they're just not able to get out of that. And that's what you want to try to do. If you can get somebody out of that state of inaction and get them to a point of elevated vigor where they feel motivated to do something, that's really, I think, what a lot of us are trying to do. So our experience right now, if we look just at the vigor number, these interventions will work for about 8 out of 10 people, right, after 1 week. When we go out to an 8-week trial or a 12-week trial, we're getting up into the low 90s. It's never going to be 100%, right? Not everybody's going to respond to these sorts of interventions, but 82% at week 1, 91-92% at week 8 or week 12, I'll take that. You know, I'll take 8 or 9 out of 10 people. So let me just conclude with a couple of quick bullet points. If we think of it this way, whether we think of it, you know, 65 to 90% of people have enough stress to have a detrimental health outcome, or we think of it this way, the top reasons that people go to their primary care doc is because of stress and fatigue and depression. And you won't walk in and say, hey, doc, my vigor is really low. I need something for that, right? You'll use whatever language you're going to use, and the intervention may or may not be matched to what you're going through. We talked a little bit about that before. The magnitude of the effect that we're seeing here, this 20% or so change in global mood state, is roughly equivalent to some of the things that are out there. And then importantly, I think, at least in my world, my nutrition world, sometimes you'll see interventions that work in the laboratory but don't always work out in the real world. And when we do these trials, we try to make it transferable to the real world. So what we're doing in the lab and the clinic is something that can be applied out with most people, because in these studies, we see that this program, exercise, nutrition, supplementation, effective in maintaining vigor, mood, hormone balance in humans, right? We're not looking at test tube. We're not looking at animal data. We're looking at in humans at the recommended usage levels. These are people who were not confined to a hospital setting or confined to a specific, you know, delivered to them regimen. These are people who were given recommendations and they were able to follow them out in the world. And then under conditions of elevated psychological and physical stress, which is the typical situation these days. You know, I like to come at it from a standpoint of not trying to identify the people who need this, but assuming that everybody needs this because our population is so overstressed, whether we look at statistics or we just look around ourselves. Okay? So with that, I'll leave you. I'm going to skip over these last couple. As a biochemist, sometimes I talk about other aspects of biochemistry. But this is where we're trying to get people. We're trying to get them to health. And whether we modulate this aspect or another aspect of biochemistry, we're all going to the same place. Okay? So thanks a lot for listening this morning. I appreciate it.